You're listening to Exec Insights, conversations about Australian business and the changing world, brought to you by QUT Executive Education. I'm Kate Joiner from QUT Graduate School of Business, and with me is a colleague in the graduate school, Aubrey Warren. As well as being a colleague, Aubrey teaches leadership and communication to our postgraduate students. He's also an executive coach and a writer. Most recently, Aubrey wrote with Tim Baker and someone else who also teaches with me in the Graduate School of Business here at QUT. They both wrote Conversations at Work, Promoting a Culture of Conversation in the Changing Workplace. Hi, all.
Hi.
Well, thank you for being my very first subject.
I'm looking forward to it. This is kind of exciting and daunting all at once.
Well, yeah, exactly. I also thought the same thing. But I'll actually start with the second part of that title, which is the culture of conversations in the changing workplace. So do you think like the nature of our conversations have actually changed in the workplace, maybe in the last decade? Because I'm actually just reading Tom Friedman's new book called Thank You for Being Late, but his premise is that things started to change fundamentally about 2007, and I have to read exactly why he thinks that. But so 2007, nearly a decade from 2007. So do you think in that 10 years our conversations have actually changed?
I think they're probably changing a lot. You know, I think about when I started work back in the 1780s, that there were very shortly thereafter. I'm not quite that old, but there was very much a hierarchical kind of structure, and that as much as we talk about that not existing anymore, we talk about flattened hierarchies and structures and informality and all of those things. It's a reality that there's still a tension. That on the one hand, we know that's the way that it should be, and it'd be richer if it was that way. And we have little pockets of it. There are moments of it. And then it's like we also have the rigidity. And I think under pressure, and maybe, I don't know, whether 2007, 2008 with the GFC, under pressure we tend to revert back to that control mechanism. We pull back in, and with that comes, I think, the hierarchy and maybe the formality. And that kind of makes sense. In times of pressure, you want clarity of communication. You want a single message. You want people who take charge. I think of the floods in Brisbane.
I was just thinking exactly the
there
same.
We are.
And we were so glad that there was a hierarchy, really.
In absolutely.
A way, the hierarchy had its purpose, but then the emergent conversations were important too. We needed both, didn't we?
Exactly. And, and that... It's a model that I often refer to, because we do talk about the need for informal communication. We talk about the sharing of information. We talk about that emergent approach as being incredibly rich and part of collaboration. And on the other side of it, we need the command and control, the directive communication. And even when you talk to people who work in those emergency service areas and the military and so on, that we typically associate with a top-down command and control structure, one-way communication, they also know that in the aftermath of the crisis, of the critical event, if you're going to learn, the after-action review type stuff requires that you break those barriers down, where you can be transparent and vulnerable about what's happening.
Transparent and vulnerable. We need both.
So I think, and yeah, the floods was a great example. I remember sitting, we were on the Gold Coast at the time, and I was sitting there watching the television saying, Campbell Newman, tell me what to do. I've got to take my own shovel. And I was making notes, and it was great to have somebody who just seemed to know what was going on. As we know from history, it didn't work out so well in a different context. It didn't translate as effectively.
That's right. So it does depend on context or what the nature, what's facing your organisation
at
the time.
Which I think... Going back to your original question about the nature of conversations, I think our expectation about conversations has changed, and our expectations of leadership increasingly become more and more demanding. The expectations get higher and higher, and we need people to be adaptable, genuinely to be adaptable in their communication style, which is not unreasonable if we want the people that we're working with to be adaptable. Then we have to be adaptable ourselves, and not least in the ways that we communicate.
Yeah, in the way that we communicate. So yeah, when I was reading your book, it did seem you did talk about mindset quite a lot. And it did occur to me that we need to think about what assumptions we bring to the conversations that we're having. So, and you do talk quite usefully about the psychological contract, traditional and perhaps new psychological contracts. And I think so Reid Hoffman wrote, who is ex-CEO of LinkedIn. So he wrote Tours of Duty. I don't know if you've seen that one, but they're talking about the new compact. So we would say psychological contract. So it is that we need to be upfront about our expectations of each other, mutual expectations in organisations. So that we are upfront that we as employees may not stay here for a long time, and we as employers may not want you to stay for a long time. So that brings a new dimension, I suppose, to ideas about developmental conversations and our assumptions. And I think you do talk about this in the book with Tim, is that we conversations, particularly in the developmental space, performance appraisals tend to be a little bit dry, and maybe what Lindsay Grattan and Samantha Grosher would talk about as dehydrated
talk,
task related. So yes, and that I think perhaps we need to question that assumption. I think that was in your book. Is that about what are these conversations all about, really?
Yeah, what are we trying to achieve? If they're developmental conversations, if that, you go back to expectations of leaders, and one of the things that we talk about is leaders should create leaders, and I know that can get a bit overdone. But fundamentally, is it not about bringing out the best in other people? Maximising, whether you want to look at that in purely transactional terms, what can you bring to my team, my company, my project?
Or what is my expectation of you?
Exactly, And then how do I enable you to make the best possible contribution you can make? Now, that's developmental. And the way that that's going to be communicated is through the conversations that we have every day. And so, Tim's written, his previous book was The End of the Performance Review, and we included it in this one because of that dehydrated nature of it. And and his work, and informally, anecdotally, most people will say performance reviews, my goodness, and the room kind of goes quiet and the eyes roll. And and everybody says, oh, yeah, it's one of those things we have to do. And you think, well, what a wasted opportunity. Neither side is actually comfortable with it. You're not comfortable stepping formally into that power role and holding up your flip chart and telling me that I'm 4 out of 5 or 7 out of 10. And
what
everybody gets a 7. That's my,
everybody gets a 7. Is that nice? Or we all revert to the mean.
And what's a 7 mean anyway?
Yeah.
I mean, I like the notion, Mark McKergau from the social solutions focused group, he says if you're going to do those sorts of conversations, then at least give people a range to operate in and ask them where they see themselves as being a 5 out of 5 or a 10 out of 10.
Because
there's probably something that you're just awesome at. Might just be going home, but there's something that we're all awesome at. And that should be acknowledged. And then with that out on the table, then there's room to say, there's some other stuff that I kind of suck at.
So are you saying that so I as an employee maybe should initiate that kind of review type conversation if we're going to engage in it?
It was interesting. Recently, I was at a workshop run by one of Google's people leaders.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd just been doing some reading around some of the stuff that they do. And she talked about their principles around transparency. And one of the things that she said is that they do quarterly, I think, reviews of how they're performing against their target objectives or something like that. They've got a name for it. And it actually starts at the top. So if you're the top of the organisation, you go first.
Oh, okay.
And and you tell the organisation, this is how I'm doing.
This is how I'm doing.
Yeah, and then it cascades down.
Yeah.
And I think that's not a bad model.
Well, if we all make ourselves a bit vulnerable about and having what they call a growth mindset, that's very popular at the moment too, isn't it?
And I think that's a key word, which goes to the harder conversations. Mm. What are your best conversations? The best conversations are where you have a little aha moment, or where we get that sort of mind share about something. And that doesn't always mean being in furious agreement, but actually getting clarity about what we're talking about and what matters.
What matters.
And really, really going to town on it. I mean, some of the best conversations in workplaces are where people actually disagree, but they disagree about the topic, not about each other's view of it, not trying to correct each other or anything, but actually say, I see what you mean, and I can see how that would work, but honestly, I'm just really uncomfortable with it.
And that's labelling an emotion, isn't it? Being uncomfortable with it. Yeah, it would seem to me that, I mean, this year, 2016, brought this into furious light, capable we are of actually having a constructive conversation that's about issues and doesn't immediately escalate into, well, you're a Do Americans say you're a jackass? Yeah.
There's been a lot of that about.
Yeah, but it's a bit of skill in that, because you've got to. There's a bit of emotional regulation around it.
And most of the advice around difficult conversations, and this has been a year for them, but I think mostly we've avoided them, because my sense, and whether you talk politics here or in an amplified sense in the recent US election, is a lot of people shouting at each other.
Mm.
And nobody, when was the last time you listened to a political disagreement between people and actually thought one side or the other learned something from it?
Yes, when going into a discussion, there seems to be a lot of heat and not a lot of light. I try to avoid those. I want a bit of light.
Yeah.
If you can illuminate something for me, I'm all yours, even if I disagree with you. If you make something clear that we've progressed the ball, I think.
Yeah. Mm. And I think, go back to that word vulnerability that you were talking about before, I think there's a real opportunity in there, because all of the advice on difficult conversations comes back to a couple of fundamental principles. And one of the first ones is, be clear about what you're talking about.
Mm.
And the second one is, you can only actually manage yourself.
Thank you.
You can't manage me in any conversation, but you can manage yourself.
Mm.
And so I often say to people in workshops, as long as one of you stays somewhat sane in the conversation, there's a chance you'll make some progress.
Mm.
But if you're both going nuts, then just sell tickets and at least get entertainment value out of it. Because that's about all that's there. There's so much heat, but not much light. But I think especially in that leadership space, one of the things we look for from people in responsible roles, whether it's formal or informal, is that sense of calmness.
Mm.
So when things are going crazy, if someone can be calm and maintain the flow of communication, the conversation.
If you can keep your head well about you. You'll be a man, my son.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we need that. But I'm worried that we're losing, at least in the public space, the modelling of that. It's almost like who can shout the loudest and who can win most people on their side. And it's really quite sad.
Mm. Speaking about, I guess, winning people to your side, I think you and Tim do talk about the use of social media in organisations and the use of Yammer. So it's kind of circling back to an earlier point, I think. But is there any evidence that that's kind of democratizing communication and decision making, or is it amplifying some poor things and maybe having it, like most things, it has an upside and some downside? Yeah, what do we know?
I don't know a lot about it,
mm.
but I think you've just summarized what I do know about it pretty well.
Mm.
That it's both. So we're amplifying, and you're getting this sort of echo chamber effect. I think that's one of the downsides of social media is we can end up in worlds in which we're in furious agreement.
Mm.
And not, again, there can be lots of heat, but not a lot of light.
Mm.
The other side of it is it's got wonderful potential. There's an example in the book from, I think it's the Value Chain organization in the US, where they actually asked across the business for people to engage in the issues that they were dealing with.
Mm.
One of my favourite examples goes back a few years in the UK to the National Health Service, where a throwaway comment at a conference from somebody who said, if you have an idea for how things could be improved here, just put it out there on social media and see what happens.
Mm.
And somebody in the audience said, we could do that, and started it up internally. And they got some tens of thousands of ideas and then actually took responsibility for operationalizing them each, and it's been continuing ever since. And I think it's a great way to tap the wisdom that's out there and give a somewhat unfiltered opportunity for ideas to come up, and they're not all great ideas.
Yeah,
so they can be
shared. Unfiltered, that's the key to it. Because I did hear that, when we try to hopefully introduce things like Yammer into our organizations, if you're allowed to, as soon as there's a whiff of hierarchy about it, like the CEO is looking and vetting, it does seem to kill any those kind of innovative initiatives that you want.
Yeah. Which is back to what you were talking about earlier about the psychological contract.
Mm.
The expectation is that we will be permitted to share our views and that we won't have Big Brother censoring and editing.
Mm.
And isn't it better to know what's being thought and said than to force it back into the dark corners? I mean, it's always there.
So.
I mean, we used to call it the grapevine.
Mm.
And it still exists, but But if we can have sort of a more open grapevine, then there's an opportunity to say, you know what, that's rubbish. Mm. Here are the facts. Or, it's kind of 50% right, 50% wrong. Mm. Here's the actual story.
So when organisations approach you, and I know they do and they want to, perhaps they grasp the idea that we, you know, want a culture of conversations, where would you start exactly? how does that process work?
Yeah. Ideally, it starts at or very near the top.
Okay.
Because the reality is what's modelled and what people experience from their leaders sends its own very powerful signal. Mm. So we trust what we see. The brain's a visual processor and we look for the visual cues, what's really going on around here. So it was Chris Aguirre's talked about the espoused values and the values in action, and we always bias to values in action. And one of the most common questions that comes out of workshops is people sit there and go, this is really good, because they always say it's really good in my workshops. And they say, this is really good, but has my boss done this? And if the boss hasn't done it, you can almost, you do, sometimes you see the shoulders slump or the sideways look like, well, is this really going to go anywhere?
But it'll have no
That's it, yeah. So ideally you start at or near the top. Mm. At least get that buy-in, that endorsement is really important. Mm. And then my process is you have to start with the individual. What do you know about yourself in terms of the ways in which you communicate? Mm. And so I really, you know, unashamedly introduce the idea of conversations and just get people having conversations with each other and then ask them, talk about the power of conversation, the fact that organisations are conversations. Mm. That's our experience of our teams, of our relationships, of the projects, of our clients. It always comes back to the conversation. Mm. And the conversation that we have today is shaped by the last conversation we have. Mm-hmm. And our next conversation is in the process of being shaped by this one. Mm. So it's a very relational and living dynamic thing. Mm. And when you introduce power in that as well, now it just gets amplified because everything you say and do or don't say and don't do just gets amplified. And I think we have to remind people in leadership roles that the higher up you go, the bigger the picture gets to people. Mm. You know, they're watching and listening and paying a lot more attention. Mm. So I just start with this notion of this very mundane idea of conversations, but their power. Mm. And then ask people, where do you have your best conversations? Mm. And why? Mm. And it's fascinating that invariably people come back unprompted. They come back to, where do I have my best conversations? Over coffee.
So it's the
outside the office, it's the informal. And we've known for a long time that informal communication is much more powerful than formal communication because we switch from that kind of critical judgment, assessment, analytical approach to being participants in what's going on. There's more of a sense.
Yeah. So that's what we've got to kind of try to aim
for.
So to break. So I'm thinking we try to break down hierarchy and status wherever. Although, you know, having said that, it's not, you know.
It'll always be there.
Quickly, yeah.
It'll always be there. Mm. And again, it's back to that adaptability. Mm. And what Goffey and Jones talk about, a wonderful book called Why Should Anyone Be Led by You? And they talk about managing closeness and distance. Mm-hmm. There are times to be close and then there are times to be distant. Mm. And being able to switch between the two. Mm. Because going back to what we said before, there are times when all the eyes in the room turn to you and say, Kate, tell us what to do. Mm. And maybe that's what we need at that moment. And there are other times where you might be the first among equals at the table. Mm. So
there is an art to that. To knowing when to make the call and knowing when to throw it open.
Yeah.
And when to be a participant and when to call shots.
Yeah.
Because we do need to call shots occasionally, don't we?
Absolutely.
And people do look for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is everyone capable of improving the nature and the quality of their conversation?
Yeah. I think if they want to. Some people tend, you know, just as we all have natural inherent strengths or talents in certain areas, it's more comfortable for some than others. But we often talk now about coaching as an essential leadership skill. And what's that?
We talk a lot about that.
We talk a lot about that here, particularly, and for good reason.
Yeah, we do.
Back to the developmental, back to the psychological contract, back to the culture of the organisation. And that's a conversation. It's an intentional conversation, but it's a conversation. Mm. And so, you know, there are skills in conversation, and probably the preeminent one is being able to listen. Mm. I mean, it's not a new thought. I think it was Dale Carnegie who said in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. You'll win more friends in 3 minutes of listening than 3 hours of talking.
I know, it's perennial, isn't it? Yeah. It's amazing how Dale Carnegie is still...
it still works.
I know, it's still most often talked about. Business books, yeah. So, that's an art in itself, isn't it? The art of listening.
Yes, and just to complete that thought about... Can people learn these skills? It is challenging, and it's not uncommon to get a bit of pushback around, oh, this stuff about having conversation. We haven't got time for conversations. Mm-hmm. And you know, we get that. But it's funny that we never seem... It's easy to say we don't have time for those conversations, the developmental conversations, the after-action review, the collaboration, mm-hmm. whatever it might be, even just the coffee conversation, the get acquainted, show some interest in people. We haven't got time for that. When we get our work done, then we'll have those conversations. Well, we never seem to have time to invest in those conversations, but we always have time to pay with interest when things go wrong.
Mm.
We've always got time to be dragged through the mediation, to be dragged through, but you know, you said, they said, we said, we didn't explain that very well, and unpack it all. And that's it's not wasted time, it's essential, but what a shame when if we'd invested in the connections up front that enable better conversations, then we can really get to the collaboration a lot more quickly.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's a stretch zone. There are people who take readily to it and others who learn it, but usually when they've been in that environment. One of the things I love is working with teams who then go away and they do some work and they come back to report to each other about what I tried and how it went. And one of the interesting things, especially when they're groups of supervisors or managers, leaders across different parts of the organisation, is when they get back and talk about their experience, they almost invariably go into this other conversation, which is about the conversation they're having there. And they say, we don't do this enough. And all the heads nod. We don't actually spend time together as peers being vulnerable with each other and saying, this is what I'm struggling with. Have you got some advice for me? Can you coach me? It's a fascinating process. I think it speaks to the value of the conversation.
So do you reckon that face-to-face is still the gold standard?
It's pretty hard to beat because there's so much going on. It's, we say it's synchronous. And so we can check out the apparent misunderstanding, you know, the fact that you nodded in response to something or that you had a furrowed brow or whatever it is. We can read those nonverbal cues. It's incredibly rich, and we do get into that kind of mind share space. And they say that when we strike that rapport, that our brains actually fire in the same ways, which kind of turbocharges the sense making. As soon as you put some distance in, and technology is getting much, much better. I mean, some of the video resources now is fantastic.
Yeah, I know. It's nearly as good.
It's nearly as good as, yeah. Yeah. At least it allows us to see each other.
Mm.
And when, in the better platforms like that, when somebody talks over the top, everything doesn't just crash. It would be, wouldn't that be bizarre in face-to-face conversations if we both talked at the same time and everything just stopped and it was like, it would be weird.
Yeah.
But we compensate for it, but it does throw the conversation in video. So it's nice that that's really improving.
Mm. Well, I think, I mean, I like this as a first topic because conversations at work, it's a very democratic kind of concept. Mm. So we're not maybe all involved in finance. We may all not be involved in strategy, but we all have conversations.
And if we can get the conversations going across disciplines like that, think how much better coordinated and smarter we can become.
One of the things we're certainly working on here. But thanks, all.
Thank you, Kate.
That's the end of it. But there's one final thing. Mm. So I've been thinking about what would, a signature sort of thing for our podcast. And I would like just to, so I think I modelled this on the Slate Political Gabfest, probably a direct take. They have what they call cocktail chatter. So just something that's caught your attention.
Yeah, so I think we're in that exciting and unnerving connected world. So I've been going back through The Seventh Sense, and how I got onto that was in the Northern Hemisphere summer, they produce, you know, what a leader's going to be reading this summer. And so I looked through the list and one title kept popping up. It was called The Seventh Sense. And I thought, well, I should see what they're all reading about. And it's very similar stuff. It's about this richly connected world that we live in. The fact that everything is connected moves at a completely different speed, and that we don't have the instinct to deal with it, and that the leaders of the future will have what he's calling a seventh sense. to be able to instinctively understand the power and the potential of this connected world. And I have to confess, I do not have it. I'm struggling to get past five senses. and I can kind of see it. And his one of his arguments is the formal leadership of our world, the typical power structures, have no clue at all. And I can completely get that, because we were raised in a different age. We're kind of looking over the fence at this new world.
Yes. Now that you mention it, I think I did, I probably downloaded the sample, you know, from, from Amazon.
Yeah.
yes, to say, yes, we're just not evolved. We haven't evolved far enough at the moment to and really capture. Yeah.
Interestingly, he starts the book by talking about a Chinese master, Master Nan, who's now in his 90s, who actually encourages that notion of calm that we were talking about before, the importance of actually not simply getting swept along and reacting to everything that's happening, but noticing, so mindfulness, if you like, so that we can actually get some sort of a grasp on what's happening and what its potential is, so we're not reacting or being overwhelmed by it, but developing an instinct for it. It's kind of counterintuitive that to speed up, we need to slow down.
Yeah, I'll have to. I think I probably did download that at the time, so I'll have to go back and have a look at that one.
It's another one of those kind of exciting slash scary question mark, what next
type books. Let's go with excited,
shall we? Yeah, let's.
As we go into Christmas, let's stay with excited.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks, Aubrey. So I'll be seeing
you, Kate.
In one of our seminars.
Yes. Yeah. Enjoy the Christmas break.
And
see you next year.
Bye. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Exec Insights. For more information about QUT's executive education programs, please search QUT Executive Education and you'll find a full range of our programs and services.